like to call the Education Subcommittee for Joint Ways and Means to order. And today we're going to have an informational meeting. That's the desire. So first, and I'm going to, instead of having each member on the committee introduce themselves, people have been talking to me about efficiency and time. So what I'm going to do, the idea today is again, informational meeting on health licensing boards. Prior to that, we're going to get an orientation from LFO analyst Steve Bender, and then the State Library Overview, and then Teacher Standards and Practices Commission Overview. And before we get into that, I wanted to point out some important people in the room. No, not my colleagues sitting up on the dais, although they're extraordinarily important. Some of the people who are the important support staff, although I don't even know if I want to use the word support because it's beyond that, but just some people that are really critical to what all of us do. And first I wanted to point out some of the folks from the Legislative Fiscal Office, some of the budget analysts who will be helping us out and working. If you could raise your hand, Darren Hill, who's the K-12 LFO budget analyst, and then Deborah Manthe, and I hope I'm pronouncing your last name correctly. Thank you very much. Who does the health-related licensing boards as a LFO budget analyst, and then Michelle Deister, who is the analyst for State Library. Fantastic. And also, there are a couple people here from Legislative Council. Cindy Hunt over there, and Joan Robinson, and both from Legislative Council. And from the Budget and Management Division, known as BAM, we'll try not to use that acronym too often, Bill McGee. Greetings, Bill. Thank you. And thank all of you for being here. Again, the idea is to do the, 50,000.
Yes.
Thank you, Steve, for pointing out. Also, someone who's very critical, Eric Sorensen, who's the committee assistant, and really in charge of making sure our internet. No, I'm giving you an extra job. So. And yes, and finally, I'm going to turn it over to LFO budget analyst Steve Bender, who's going to do the subcommittee orientation, so those of us sitting on this committee understand what it is expected of us. And I'm going to turn it over to Mr. Bender. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would like to walk through a couple of items with you to talk about the subcommittee's work plan for this particular legislative session, and to talk about some of the rules that under which the subcommittee operates, particularly those rules that might be different than some of the other committees which you may be members of. You should have before you a memo here, an item that's stapled together that starts off with a memo. Basically, I'll be working through this memo and just pointing out a few things about the subcommittee operations for this legislative session. I do want to mention to members and to the audience as well that the configuration of chairs that you see in the room today is unusual and not the way it will typically be done. Typically, the chairs will all be facing you. The reason why they are set up this way today, and they will be tomorrow as well, is because this room had been used earlier for a special presentation of a joint Ways and Means subcommittees and a policy committee. But typically, the room would not be set up in this particular format. And we apologize if it's inconvenient for any of you in the audience today to be sitting facing that direction. But we ask the following of you. If you look at the memorandum which has been distributed to you, one thing we do ask is that you or your staff notify LFO at the number shown if you're unable to attend a meeting. This way we'll be able to get that information to the chair in a timely manner. So please do that if you know that you will be unable to attend the meeting. Another thing that I would like to go through is some of the rules that apply to the subcommittee. As a subcommittee of Joint Ways and Means, you do not have to adopt committee rules. The rules that govern the subcommittee were adopted by the full committee last week. A copy of those committee rules is attached. Those are the last two pages of this handout here. But what I would like to do is point out a few items that are particularly important to the subcommittee from those joint committee rules. First of all, the subcommittee is required by Ways and Means rules to report all budget bills that the co-chairs have assigned to you back to the full committee. And what this means is that unlike for other committees where a large portion of the bills that are assigned to you may end up still in committee upon adjournment, that will not be the case here. All of these budget bills need to be reported back to the full committee for action. The co-chairs may indeed remove any bill from the subcommittee at any time. So this is very rarely done, but if they're concerned that you're not taking timely action on a budget, they can take a budget out of the subcommittee and move it to another subcommittee at any time they are permitted to do that. If you go to the second page here of this handout, what you see here is a list of the budget bills that the co-chairs have assigned to education this session. And these bills are the same as, these agencies are the same as were assigned last session and have generally been assigned to the Ways and Means Education Subcommittee. The important thing to note is that all of the education budgets are assigned to the subcommittee. There are essentially six state agencies that are education budgets for K-12, covering from K-12 through post-secondary education. There's also a number of agencies that are not education related, but whose budgets the co-chairs have assigned to the subcommittee. There are 15 health licensing boards that are assigned to the subcommittee. And actually, most of your initial work will be on those budgets initially. The co-chairs have asked that these budgets be reported out back to the full committee if possible, so that they can then move on to the floors after the floors start meeting every day in early March. So we have scheduled these budgets early in the process. Please note that all of these 15 budgets are entirely other funded, which means that their expenditures are made from fees that are levied on licensed professionals. And some of them, quite frankly, have hardly any budget issues that you'll find. I mean, they're not, this will vary, but some of them will be quite simple in terms of budget. And the co-chairs have asked for an expedited process for some of these simpler budgets, which we have been working into the schedule. One thing I do wish to ask you to note, however, is that these health licensing boards form a very important role in that they are designed to protect the public from unscrupulous practitioners, and there's potential in all of these professions for there to be serious harm if the licensing process is not done effectively. And these budgets, when these agencies come before you, very often this is the only time the legislature looks at the operations of these agencies, every 2 years. So please, if you have any concerns as you hear the presentations about how the agencies are operating, whether they're operating effectively or not, it's important to let your chair here know, so that if additional time needs to be set aside to review this, that this is done, because again, there may be no other opportunity at all.
Excuse me, Representative Morgan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Bender, during previous sessions with the boards and commissions, the co-chairs have given the sub-chair instructions relating to the ending balance of these folks and whether it's too big or not big enough to meet their cash flow needs. Have the co-chairs given us any instructions about that?
We have received no specific instructions this year relating to the ending balances amounts, though this will be an element of LFO's review of these, particularly in cases where there are questions of the fee levels and whether these are set at appropriate amounts.
May I have a follow-up?
Follow-up.
So, Mr. Bender, will we be seeing then cash flow analysis for these agencies?
I believe that the agencies, that the analysts may be reporting to you cash flow issues. I don't know if they have worked up a regular type of presentation for all of these budgets, and I don't believe that the agencies themselves have been asked to do that on their own. In addition to the 15 licensing boards, there is one other non-education agency that is in your that has been assigned to you, and that is the State Library, which has both fees and general fund in its budget. On this list of bills, I've also included the names and telephone numbers of the analysts. Please feel free, of course, to contact us when you have any questions. Another thing that I'd like to talk to you about is, well, I'm sorry, if I go back to the memo, back to the front page again, some other rules relating to the subcommittee operations that are somewhat unusual are the following. Since all budgets, well, associated with the fact that all budgets need to be reported back, there are no minority reports allowed in Ways and Means, so that is an exception from your general committee rules. Another thing that is different from most committees is this is, of course, a joint committee, and the quorum rules reflect that. Basically, what has to occur is, even though you're meeting jointly, in some sense you're voting separately on each issue. And in order for a committee action to pass, there must be approval by both the House and the Senate members independently. Since this committee has five senators and five representatives, the quorum is three senators and three representatives. And the vote needed to approve or to take any action or certainly to report a bill back to full committee is, again, must receive affirmative vote of at least three senators and of at least three representatives. So if there are five senators that vote for something and only two reps, it doesn't pass, even though that's seven votes. If three of you on each side vote yes, it does pass, even though that's six votes. But this reflects the joint process of the committee. If one thing to point out as well, when talking about the quorum here, please note that the Oregon Open Meetings Law requires you to not discuss or deliberate on committee business whenever there's a quorum unless you're in a formally noticed meeting. So if you're ever in a situation where, you know, there are three of you from the House and three of you from the Senate together, we recommend that you do not talk about committee business outside of the committee. And there'll be some times when this actually happens quite naturally, and sometimes when we're here with LFO, we'll point this out to you. The times when we tend to see it is, you know, before the meeting starts, if you're sitting here and waiting for the meeting to start, or after it adjourns, if you're still hanging around, it's very easy to just continue to talk about these things, and we will, if we observe this, say, you know, excuse me, you know, you've got to stop, this meeting hasn't been noticed. So, but when you're not there, this rule applies 24/7. So when we're not around, please try to remember this rule. The co-chairs and vice chairs of the joint committee may participate in any subcommittee meetings and may vote when they are attending the meeting. But only one of them can vote at a time from each side of the chamber. And what this effectively means in terms of voting is, as you know, it's three senators and three reps. If on any particular in any particular chamber there's only the support of two instead of three, effectively what this means is if the co-chairs would like or do support the action that doesn't have three members supporting it, they can come in to the meeting and vote to approve that, and it would pass. That's effectively what that rule means. Budget notes. Budget notes must be approved by the subcommittee chair and by the co-chairs of Ways and Means before they can be considered by the subcommittee. So if you have something that you would like to have added as a budget note in an agency's budget report, please be sure to contact first your subcommittee chair, Representative Galizio, who will then, if this is something that he wishes to bring forward, bring this also to the co-chair's attention. Budget notes may only clarify or expand upon administrative requirements which are directly related to the execution of budgets during the fiscal period covered. That's a direct quote from your committee rules. And what this means is that the budget note, which is actually a language that is voted on in subcommittee and that has direction to the agency as to how they are to execute their budgets, has to be limited to issues of executing that budget. And if the scope of the budget note is beyond that, then it will not be accepted under the committee rules as a budget note. I don't know if anyone has any questions about this at this time or needs additional clarification. I'll be happy to do that. Otherwise, I'll just go on. Typically, the co-chairs will not reassign a bill to a subcommittee after it passes the first chamber. So if you're working on a budget for a particular agency, generally you have one shot at it in the sense that once you approve it, you cannot assume that it will be coming back either to this subcommittee or to any other subcommittee or committee in the future. Because it's a joint committee, typically it goes from this subcommittee to the full joint committee, then to the House of Origin, and then directly to the second house without ever coming back for a committee meeting in the second house. So that's very unusual, but that is the process that we use here. In terms of passing out bills, after you approve or if you report out a measure, it will go to the full Ways and Means Committee, and the chair will appoint a carrier to carry that bill to the full Ways and Means, similar to the way that a bill is carried to the floor. The carrier has to be a member of full Ways and Means. I know some of you are and some of you aren't, but the carrier has to be a member of full Ways and Means, and Legislative Fiscal will assist you in presenting that bill to Ways and Means, the full committee, and that will prepare a pony which has basic information about the bill that you can choose to read if you'd like when it comes before full committee. The chair will also appoint a carrier to both the House and Senate floors, and these carriers do not need to be members of full Ways and Means necessarily. And again, if you are a carrier of a budget bill or any bill that comes out of this subcommittee that goes to the floor, we will again prepare a pony for you. We will be there on the side aisle when your bill is up. If you need us to, if you'd like the LFO analyst to be at your desk, just ask us and we will do that. Some materials that you can expect to be getting, LFO will distribute a weekly or biweekly schedule to your office each Wednesday or Thursday. If you look on this handout here, actually the third page shows what this looks like. I don't know if you've seen this yet at all this session. This is already one that was distributed to your office last week. So this you can be on the lookout for if you have any questions about what is coming up. That will be distributed. Each day we will distribute to you an agenda that looks like this, that will indicate what is on today's agenda, and to the extent that we know or expect certain people to come before you, we will list them and list their titles for you. We will also be distributing to your offices the agency presentation materials, budget priority forms, performance measure information, hopefully 1 week before the agency's budget is first scheduled for a public hearing. I'm told agencies they need to get this to us in time for us to distribute this to you 1 week in advance. This is somewhat out of our control because these materials are being provided by other people, and if we can't get it to you, we won't. If the chair determines that because of the tardiness, this makes it impossible for you to do your work properly, we'll have to reschedule the meetings of the agencies. And we've told them that if they don't get their materials in time, they may not be able to come off as scheduled. But that will be the chair's prerogative. A couple of other items that we've been asked to go over to in this orientation is just to talk a bit about roll call protocol. Typically, there will not necessarily need to be a roll call in the subcommittee. If there's any doubt, though, or if any of you request it, so if there's any objections, and you request a roll call vote as opposed to just being recorded as an objection, then we will have a roll call vote. The roll call will be called by the analyst, who's ever here, and we'll do it in that manner. So you have the right to request, any member has a right to request a roll call vote if you want. We will be following the scheduling notification requirements that are most restrictive of either house at the time of the session that we are in. Because it's a joint committee, we have to meet the more restrictive notification requirements. Currently, those are the requirements set on the House side, which state that we need 48 hours in order to a public notice before holding a public hearing or a work session or any meeting on any particular meeting. However, in the event of a first public hearing held during this by the subcommittee, we require 72 hours notification. Actually, that last provision is the only provision where the House and Senate rules differ at this point. But we will be scheduling according to those rules. This will provide the public with a lot of lead time before you take action on any items here. During the course of the session, typically these rules are changed and relaxed, and whatever body, whichever house has the more restrictive rules at that particular point in time are the ones that will apply to joint ways and means and to its subcommittees. There is one exception to the notification rules, and that is if you are working on a bill or on a either in a public hearing or work session, and you simply run out of time, it takes longer than you planned, and you want to continue your work without needing to take a two-day or three-day break, the subcommittee chair may carry the bill over to the next meeting day. So if you run out of time, you can carry the meeting over as long as a public announcement is made before you adjourn the subcommittee, and as long as it's the same type of meeting as you were hearing. So if you had a public hearing, you couldn't say, well, tomorrow we're going to do a work session, even though we hadn't posted it. But you could say, we need more time for the public hearing. We're announcing here that we're going to do that tomorrow. Let me see. Anything else? Okay. One thing we do want to talk a little bit about the room here. We do have a meeting, an earlier committee meeting of the Human Services Subcommittee that meets prior, and that only their meeting only ends a half hour before yours begins. This is unusual. We haven't tried in the past to schedule Ways and Means subcommittees with only a half hour break, and it will be very difficult to get the room in order in time for this committee. So we ask your patience. We will try to be available for you at 3:00. Sometimes the earlier subcommittee doesn't leave until later, and that makes it a little more difficult for us. But we do ask that the subcommittees try to keep to the schedule because of this tight scheduling. And we also ask that you try to leave the room quickly after this meeting is over. Even though we don't have another meeting scheduled right after here, we do have to get the room set up for the 8:30 meeting in the morning. So we do ask that you move and allow us to get this work done. Please know, you've probably heard this before, and those of you who have been in the building before certainly remember this, that the microphones are very sensitive, and any conversation, side conversation you might have with your colleagues, you have to assume that it's probably going to be, you know, heard. So please note that, and also note that the when we switch off the microphones, they do stay on and continue to pick up for 30 seconds or whatever afterwards. So please note that these are very sensitive, and we ask that you remember that. And finally, the last thing that I, on my list of things to talk to you about, is the 2% reprioritization amount that the co-chairs have adopted, a process the co-chairs have asked the subcommittees to look into this time around. To provide a little more information about what that is all agencies, all subcommittees are asked to find 2% reductions in agency budgets in order to free money that can then be reprioritized for legislative priorities. What this will be, what we will ask you to do, and we are going to be, the agencies are aware of this, and we're asking them for some input from them to give you some ideas of what they think might be the best way to do this, is by fund type, so general fund, lottery fund, other funds, federal funds, we will, the co-chairs have set a target of 2% of the essential budget level of each of those fund types. We will be providing you, we haven't calculated it yet, so it's a pretty simple calculation, we just don't have it quite yet, but we will be giving you what these target amounts are, and you are then asked to find savings of at least this much from the governor's recommended budget amounts that would apply overall to your subcommittee.
Vice Chair Dublin?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Can you state that again so that people understand that? Because that's a very important thing for them to understand here, that you'll determine the 2% from the essential budget level, but the committees will be asked to make a 2% reduction from the governor's proposed budget.
That is correct.
This becomes very confusing to people in the audience. And as you stated, it is much clearer than we heard it last Friday, which I've had clarified since then.
Yes, the 2% actually represents a target. So we will be giving each agency an indication of what its 2% target is. We will be giving you an indication of what the 2% is by agency and then by overall, because actually it applies to the sum. So you may choose to take off 3% from one and none from another, you know, as long as it equals that target.
Mr. Chairman, and so people are misunderstanding this, that we're being asked to cut 2% from the essential budget level, which we're not actually being asked to do. We're being asked to cut 2% from the governor's proposed budget, but the 2% will be determined by the essential budget level for that budget.
Thank you, Senator Devlin, and that's, I think that's clarification not only for members of the public, but I think a lot of people on this committee, and I, you know, I have a question, Representative Morgan.
Thank you. I can see the point of asking for 2% reductions in general funded agencies where you can reallocate that money in other directions, but I'm not understanding the point of doing a 2% reduction in other funded agencies where the money is pretty directed, and you either have the choice of spending it or not spending it. Can you talk to us about what the co-chair's intention is with the 2% reductions in the other funded agencies?
Certainly. The 2%, you are certainly correct, Representative Morgan, that generally the other funds are restricted to a particular agency, and in most cases to a particular function in that agency. So if you do save 2%, it's not as if there are funds being freed up for some other agency necessarily. But the co-chair's reasoning for doing this in terms of other funds are, first of all, to look at reprioritizing if the legislative priorities for the use of the other funds in an agency is different than is being presented in the base budget or the governor's recommended budget. This will allow funds to be freed up to finance priorities in another fund's budget. Another reason why the co-chairs have asked this exercise to be applied to other funds as well as to general fund is that this may allow fee levels to be lower than they would otherwise have to be. In other words, if the other funds are being raised by fees and expenditures, the level of expenditures is lower, the fees may not need to be at the level that they would otherwise.
Representative Morgan.
Given that discussion, Mr. Bender, if the discussion is going to be around the ability to lower down the operating budget of the agency by reducing the fees, then it would point out to me just more strongly the need for a cash flow analysis so that we can make a judgment about whether the ending balances are sufficient if we take certain actions to take the agency through the biennium.
Thank you. I think all of the LFO analysts are are here in the room and they're all listening very well to what you're saying. We'll take it to heart to have that information now.
A further comment, too. I would submit that on some of these small boards and commissions that we're going to be hearing, that this is really an exercise in futility and probably not worth our time.
Representative Barnhart.
I'd like to second that comment. I think that if we start trying to do a 2% reduction in some of these small agency budgets, it requires a much more detailed analysis of the budget than I think the co-chairs want us to engage in. And if I'm wrong about that, I still would believe it would not be a good allocation of our time as compared with dealing with the larger budgets that where we might actually have a more significant effect. I think it would be appropriate to ask the co-chairs to reevaluate that instruction, at least as it relates to these other funds' budgets involving small agencies that are funded entirely from fees.
First, I'm going to go to Mr. Bender, and then we're going to go to Senator Devlin as a question.
Thank you for pointing that out, because it reminds me that I failed to clarify something regarding the 2%, the 2% exercise. Those budgets which are eligible for the expedited process, the co-chairs have exempted them from the 2%.
They've dealt with that issue already.
I did fail to mention that. I'm sorry.
Thank you, Mr. Bender. Senator Devlin.
I know that Mr. Bender would give the same answer I would give, because I had the same question in an earlier. Some of the budgets, though not particular, maybe the ones we have in this committee that are entirely not general fund, are relatively large budgets. The Department of Transportation is no small budget. And I would be willing to, I would urge anyone to take a closer look at the Department of Transportation budget.
Well, we don't have that.
No.
Thank you, Senator Devlin.
This is education.
Thank you, Mr. Bender.
I believe that completes the orientation I had planned. If there are no further questions, we could get into the agency overviews.
Okay. Anyone else on the committee have any questions that are relevant to this review? All right. Thank you very much, Mr. Bender.
I forgot one thing.
Oh, Mr. Bennett?
I just wanted to mention that these agency overviews are, the remainder of this week, you'll be receiving very brief overviews of the agencies that are in your subcommittee that you have had budgets assigned to for, and later we'll be going into the actual, analysis of their budget. This really isn't to look at their budgets. These presentations are designed to tell you what these agencies do and sort of give you some idea of how well they're doing it to the extent they can get that information in.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Mr. Bender. That's exactly what I was going to... That's fine. I appreciate that. I just wanted to make sure we all understand that, so we're not putting any undue pressure on folks. All right, well, I'd like to call, and I have not met Susan Wilson. Where is Susan Wilson? Hi, Ms. Wilson, Director of the Oregon Health Licensing Agency, to give us the first overview of the day. So if you'd please approach and...
This isn't going to work, is it?
Thank you for dealing with the logistical or the structural challenges we've had here. Whenever you're ready, go ahead and state your name. And
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Susan Wilson. I'm the director of the Oregon Health Licensing Agency. I'm asked today to appear before the committee to give you a profile, a high profile of the agency, and not go into any specifics. So we're prepared to do that as an agency, and I've handed out some information for you that I think does that. You will find the information handed out, gives you a profile of the agency, offers you some divisional recognition of each division that's providing services to the 8 boards and programs, 15 professions that we provide services to. You'll see some one-page items, front and back, which, again, is trying to give you a profile in a very brief manner. And some other one-page items that I'll go through as we enter into the testimony today. So, Chair Galezio and members of the committee, staff, most of you have are former members of the Education Committee and have heard my presentation before. We were created in 1999 by the Oregon Legislature to offer a different kind of management for boards and councils. During that process, the emphasis was on the regulatory oversight process and creating an agency that provided a point of reference for delivery of services. And what I mean by that is it met the governor's and Oregon's government's principles as it relates to licensing and regulation. It makes the regulation and oversight coverage then perform within an independent licensing agency which sets the architecture or the environment for how we license and we regulate and we discipline. So that the structure was managed in a manner that boards could be added or taken away as the legislature sees fit. The legislature at the time made a calculated shift in utilizing how boards operate and gave the discretion for setting the standards for licensing to the agency and within the agency divisions. And I want to point out for a moment, if you would like to go to the handout. The agency mission is to protect, of course, the health and safety of other small boards and programs and licensing and professionals within those organizations. And we advance our mission by actively promoting consumer protection, enforcement, and promoting a positive business environment by reducing barriers and opening the system to entry to practice for practitioners. We also provide excellent customer service through partnering with our customers and stakeholders. I wanted you to look at page 3, if you would, and this gives you a who, what, where, and how the agency operates. The individuals on the who are who we regulate. The what is how we regulate them. We don't just regulate practitioners. We also regulate businesses, facilities, corporate offices that have large businesses, contracts for dispensing hearing aids from to senior citizens. We actually oversee about 40,000 of those contracts per year. And those contracts are developed in a manner that provide a rescission right for consumers, seniors, and the elderly or anyone that has a disability for hearing and make sure they are covered under that process and that the contract allows for a money-back guarantee, basically. So we're very diverse in the amount of facilities, contracts, and people that we regulate. If you look a little further, and this may give you another idea of the boards we regulate, there's a sample of OLA, which is in the center, which is the oversight agency, and then the boards, which is plugged in for the services and the discipline, licensing, and monitoring that goes on when you're a regulator. Again, this allows Oregon Health Licensing Office, or OLA, to make sure that we are within Oregon priorities in delivering our services as far as regulation occurs, and that those are aligned with the governor's principles and governance principles. OLA has been given a governing presence that has concentrated our efforts in making regulation faster, easier, and cheaper for our licensees and those we regulate. We incorporate Oregon principles in our strategic planning, and I hope to go over some of those with you today. Our goal is to regulate in a manner that protects the public while allowing regulated individuals and businesses to to effectively compete in today's fast-moving economic environment. As I said, we regulate about 5,000 businesses, sole proprietorships, national corporations, about 7,000 independent contractors, for a total of about 83,000 licenses that we actually provide for licensees in an annual period of time. We also monitor those hearing aid purchase contracts that I discussed. We do about 40,000 of those per year. The agency initiatives have resulted in giving the agency, the regulatory agency, some oversight capabilities that don't occur in smaller boards. We have an opportunity to redesign our business practices through regulatory streamlining. We have an opportunity to redesign any laws that may be conflicting with the way folks are doing business and reporting that to the legislature or the governor. We have an opportunity to reevaluate how the workforce is operating within those statutory guidelines and within the oversight. We can communicate as a uniform group how we license and regulate. So the public has an expectation of government looking and acting and overseeing in the same manner, and we can offer that uniformity and standardization, which is very, very clearly defined in our law. Some of our achievements include expanding our consumer right principles and making sure that these are online and easily accessible for individuals who are getting services from those we regulate and for our practitioners and businesses. We've launched educational campaigns as it relates to piercing and tattooing. I know that sounds different, but the state of Oregon is involved in making sure that there are one-use needles and that we're following the CDC standards for sterilizing any sort of equipment that may come in contact with a human that may have a bloodborne disease. We also represent and educate consumers as to the challenges and medical obstacles that could occur if they do get a tattoo or a piercing that has an adverse effect. So we're doing that up front. We're not doing that hindsight. We're doing that up front to make sure that in high schools and community colleges, they have brochures that they can provide to students, and they make an informed selection before they get a tattoo or a piercing that may not be something they want in the future. We also work through a collaborative exercise of being transparent, understandable, and accessible to other agencies, other licensing boards, and make sure that we aren't creating turf battles where battles don't need to exist. We've worked with the health services of DHS in managing risk factors for birth center deliveries for direct intern midwives, making sure that we have absolute criteria in place. And one of the outcomes of that, and one of our challenges, is direct intern midwives are a voluntary licensing organization, and one of the outcomes of the sitting on the birthing center's task force was perhaps that should be a mandatory licensing experience, since they do qualify for third-party reimbursement. I don't know how much further you want me to go. I've got a lot of information here, and I guess I'll open it for questions. We also have made sure that we've worked in the regulatory streamlining venue, in the sense that we have really worked hard to make sure that when people walk into our office, they can get licensed easily if they qualify, and that we monitor them after the fact, and that we give them communication up front so they know what to expect from a regulatory agency. I've offered about 20 achievements within my testimony, and I don't want to go through every one. We're very proud of them, but I'm happy to answer questions. I am happy to compare our differences with other boards you'll hear from. I think that you need to keep in mind that the agency structure has given the central agency authority to carry out the business for regulation of the various boards that we have under our purview. Are there any questions?
Well, Ms. Wilson, first I just wanted to say thank you. I mean, this is a very difficult task, right? You have an enormous, you're talking about a lot, and we're saying, can you do this in 10 minutes? So I really appreciate the difficulty of what you're doing. And I had a question for you.
Okay.
Is the sun in your eyes? Is that bothering you?
Actually, it's very nice.
Oh, it is? Okay, well.
Vitamin D.
All right. Just let us know.
No. So, thank you.
Are there any questions of Ms. Wilson? Yes, Representative Morgan.
Just first a comment and then a question. Congratulations on getting the license renewals online. I imagine there's a large number of people that are very thankful that
yes.
they don't have to take time out of their business day to do that, and they can do it online whenever it's convenient for them. And the second one is, I was looking at your key challenges, and I know that there has been ongoing discussions around the diversity because of all of the boards and commissions that you oversee, especially around administering and dealing with the complaint side of this thing. Can you talk to us about how that's going?
Some of our challenges as it relates to that. Yes, Chairman Galizio, Representative Morgan. It has been a challenging process. I believe that because we've set some standards for discipline, and we're very transparent in the way we allow complaints to come into our office and how we process those. We have to prioritize our complaints and deliver the service of oversight and monitoring that's sufficient to make sure we are administering public protection. And I'll give you an example. Not only are we giving upfront hearing aid contract information, walking people through the process, the practitioners and the seniors that may have hearing aids, we also may have a fetal demise that comes through our office and we have to send investigators out. I would say that, and you will find this in our budget, probably our biggest challenge is trying to prioritize those complaints and trying to make sure that we are dealing with the most critical complaints in a timely fashion, and making sure that we can get the educational piece out so that we don't have complaints at the end of the process. And that's been a challenge. And our enforcement officers, as well as our communication team, has spent a lot of time doing brochures, making sure our website is very user-friendly. We've walked complainants through the system. They can file a complaint online. They can look at practitioners that may have beyond probation or a suspended license, trying to give them access to information at 2 a.m. in the morning. If they're deciding to go to a practitioner, they can look it up in our licensing system and find out whether or not the person is licensed or if they're suspended or if they're on probation or if there's any sort of action that's been taken against them. It's a challenge. It's one of our challenges we've identified in our budget in more detail, and we have asked for more positions in that particular area. More answer.
Thank you. And that is, I think, an interesting thing in trying to deal with the budgets of all the boards and the commissions, that there are performance measures, I think, in each of these budgets that deal with how the agencies work their complaints through, whether they're staying timely and whether the regulated community is happy with the service that they're getting.
Thank you, Representative Morgan. Representative Edwards.
Mr. Chair, Ms. Wilson, follow-up to Representative Morgan's last comment. On page 2 of the PowerPoint handout, you list a series of performance measures. I'm just curious how the agency is doing against those measures.
I believe we don't have the detail today, but we're doing quite well, actually, in the 80 percentile, and we're doing very, very well in each of our performance measures as far as disciplinary and contested cases. The issue that Representative Morgan was focusing on is an issue of complexity and a number of complaints. As we become more visible, people are complaining, and that's good. And as we become more visible, we're making sure we're doing the education and training up front. We're at the point over the last decade where we've increased enormously in the complaint and disciplinary process. So I think our performance measures will point to the areas that we need improvement and that we recognize we need improvement. And I think our budget policy packages also will further promote that issue.
Thank you. Senator Morse?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The agency performance, they do have some reference to their
on one page.
On the back page of one of the handouts.
Thank you, Senator Morse.
Thank you, Senator Morrison. That's a specificity you might be looking for. We have more in our budget. Thank you so much.
And also, and I think we're keeping in mind that in 3 or 4 weeks' time, we're going to be able to go into much greater detail and focus on the performance measures and the challenges and the numbers. So, are there any other questions from members of the committee? Representative Barnhart.
Thank you. You indicated some challenges, and the challenges, one of them was the direct entry midwifery and voluntary versus mandatory. Is there a bill in on that subject?
No, there is not. Part of the process of working on this task force and another piece of our budget, which hasn't passed, which is basically pooling the fees and lowering all the fees so that we're all working from a level playing field. We think with all those pieces and components in place that the mandatory issue will rise to the surface and something will happen. But I have to tell you, Representative Barnhart, we were not in a position at the time we were promoting legislation that this came after the fact. This realization of getting there came after the fact, after real legislation.
My recollection is that when we passed that bill originally, the fee was very, very high because there were very few midwives who wanted to join the licensing agency or be licensed by the agency. And I think what you're saying is that because of the common administrative center, those fees could come down quite a bit without impinging upon the licensees from other boards.
Precisely.
Is that an act? Yes. Thank you.
Mr. Chair. Yes, that's the case. Their licensing fees have been as high as $1,500. There are 33 direct entry midwives. And, of course, there may be more under mandatory licensing, but not many more than 100. And under the scenario we're offering within our budget, this biennium, we're lowering fees to $33 per practitioner across the board.
From 1,500?
Across the board for every practitioner in the agency.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Barnhart. Any other questions? All right, fantastic. Well, thank you very, very much.
I just want to Mr. Chair.
Yes, Senator Walker.
Just out of curiosity, both my children, I've had 3 children, born at home with lay midwives. How many lay midwives are practicing in the state now?
Mr. Chair, Senator Walker, currently there are 33 licensed, voluntarily licensed lay midwives. Direct entry midwives is what the statute calls them.
Mm-hmm. Great. That was a wonderful way to have a baby. Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you. Senator Walker, no further questions. Mr. Wilson, again, thank you very, very much for that brief and informative overview, and look forward to having the opportunity to go into greater depth. Thank you again very much.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. I'd now like to call up Jim Shepke, the state librarian, to give us the, as people are saying, the 30,000-foot overview of the state library. Thank you very much. If you're ready, state your name.
Yes. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Jim Shepke. I'm the state librarian, director of the Oregon State Library. I've created a presentation for you today, an overview of the state library. Michelle is handing it out, and I will be speaking from my handout, and I would appreciate it if you could follow along with me. What I would like to do, Mr. Chair, is present our mission, our goals, our key performance measures, and then what we do as an agency to carry out our mission and our goals and key performance measures. So on the first page of the handout that's in front of you, I wanted to put our mission in the context of our history. We're one of the oldest state agencies. We were founded 102 years ago in 1905, and as you can see at the bottom of the first page, our original mission was to develop library services in the state. At that time, there was only one public library in the entire state. We continue to work on that mission today. We currently serve about 1,600 school, public, and academic libraries throughout the state. In 1913, we took on a second mission, and that was to be the library for state government, to provide information to all the state agencies, and also to collect the publications of state agencies so that the history of state government could be preserved. And we do serve, as you see, 34,000 state employees. The third mission we picked up in 1969 is talking book and braille services. It's a service to Oregonians who are blind or have other disabilities, and we are the public library for about 7,000 blind and print disabled Oregonians throughout the state. On the next page, you'll see the five long-range goals adopted by the State Library Board of Trustees, and their improved library service to state government, increase usage and maintain user satisfaction, improve, adapt, and market talking book and braille services and maintain user satisfaction for eligible Oregonians, lead public libraries to achieve excellence in services to children, take a leadership role in developing a comprehensive statewide library resource sharing network, including improved citizen access to government information, and build capacity for local communities to develop school and public library services for unserved and underserved Oregonians. And on the right-hand side, you'll see 14 key performance measures that have been adopted by the legislature in each of those areas. There's one more that does not appear, and that's the one about customer service. And we do measure customer service in all these areas. And in my full presentation, I'll be giving you a lot of information about our key performance measures and how we're doing in a few weeks. And you'll see that we're doing very well on most of our key performance measures. On the next page, I wanted to show you the organization that we've created at the State Library. We're a small agency, 44 positions. We're divided into four teams, and we're a team-based organization. And each team is assigned a different piece of the three-part mission, and then we have one administrative services team. So to get into what we do, we'll start with the Library Development Services team. As you can see at the bottom of that page, we provide leadership and assistance to 1,600 local libraries throughout Oregon. That means we provide consulting and training. We have a youth services consultant. We have a technology consultant that goes out and helps libraries to improve their service. We administer the Ready to Read grant program, which helps Oregon children become more proficient readers. And we also administer federal grants that make all Oregon library resources available to every Oregonian, and we demonstrate new services using federal funds. If you look at the revenue sources, you'll see that 68% of the budget for this team does come from the federal government. It comes from the Institute of Museum and Library Services under the Library Services and Technology Act. And that's an annual sort of block grant that every state gets, and that makes up most of the budget. The general fund portion of the budget is the ready-to-read grant program. That totally flows through our agency and goes out to local libraries. And then the 9% of other funds are grants that we get from other sources. We currently have a grant from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation for public libraries that we're administering. If you turn the page, I wanted to show you the Ready to Read grant program at the top of the next page. This is not a competitive grant. This goes to every public library in the state, and I've given you some samples there of grants that are underway today in the latest round of grants that we've made. At the bottom of that page, I wanted to show you some of the federal grants that we make under the Library Services and Technology Act, And this year we've made 15 grants, as you see there, and that's a sample of some of the grants that we've made. And we make those grants to public libraries, academic libraries, and school libraries. So all libraries can apply for these grants. On the next page, two other things that Library Development Services does. We use federal funds to undertake statewide projects that provide equal access to information. And what you see at the top of that page is a statewide database licensing program. We license information databases for all the libraries in the state, and we save the taxpayers about $10 million annually by licensing, having one license for the whole state, as opposed to every library doing that individually. So it's been very, very beneficial. At the bottom of the page, two other federally funded projects. The Oregon School Library Information System is a website that's available to all our K-12 students that has these information databases on the website, and a lot of other good information that school librarians have selected to provide sort of an electronic library for our K-12 students throughout the state. And there's also a very innovative project that you see there called LNet, and this is a website that you can go to any time of the day or night, 24/7, and ask a question of a live librarian through chat or email. And we work with a network of libraries across the country so that in the middle of the night you might not get an Oregon librarian. It may be a librarian from somewhere else, but it's a very innovative service that's available now to all Oregonians. On the next page, we get into our second service, corresponding to our second mission, Talking Book and Braille Services. You see that what we do there is we partner with the Library of Congress. This is really a state and federal partnership program. We serve about 7,000 Oregonians who are blind or have other disabilities that prevent them from using their local public library. The Library of Congress supplies the collection, they supply the talking book players, and the U.S. Postal Service provides free postage. So this is a mail order service. It goes directly to the homes of these Oregonians that need the service. You'll see the revenue sources are 86% general fund and 14% other fund. The other funds are actually donations that we receive mostly from our customers. We solicit donations twice a year from our customers for this service, and we're also in the process of building an endowment fund to diversify the revenue for Talking Book and Braille Services. As you can see at the bottom of that page, we send out an average of almost 1,600 books every day, and we get back about 1,600 books every day. So it's a very high volume, well-used service. And you can see the dollar amounts of what the federal government contributes. It's very significant that they provide us with our inventory of books and players, and that we get free postage that the state doesn't have to pay for. If you turn the page, you'll see that we're among the top 20 libraries in the nation in talking book circulation, and we're very proud of that, Mr. Chair, because we're up there with states that are much bigger than Oregon. Indiana is about twice as big as Oregon, and we check out more books than they do, and Ohio is about three times the size of Oregon, and we're almost up there with Ohio. So we have a very active readership, and we're very proud of our performance. The next third and final service that I'll talk about is Government Research and Electronic Services. This is our library for state government. You can see what we do. We provide agencies and with accurate, up-to-date information from published resources, printed or electronic. We give the employees easy and immediate access to the best and most relevant information on the web via our website, which is called the State Government Information Center. We provide the search engine on Oregon.gov, that little box that you type in up in the right. That's us behind that box. We provide electronic mailing list service to all agencies. We currently host 525 electronic mailing lists, including 12 members of the legislature who use our list to send email newsletters to their constituents. And if any of you are interested in that, we'd be happy to talk to you about doing that for you. We provide permanent public access to the publications of state government. So we preserve the history of state government. We make that accessible to Oregonians. And we provide a new service called State Library Eclipse, which I will show you in a minute. This service is funded 100% by an assessment on state agencies. And it's been that way since 1993, and it's worked very well to support this service. If you'll turn the page, just a few things that this unit does that I wanted to show you in greater detail. Here is our website, the State Employee Information Center. About 670 visits. Employees come to this site about 670 times a day, so it's very active, very well used to get information from our databases, from our catalog, and from other resources. At the bottom of that page, I've shown you the search box on Oregon.gov. We monitor what people type in there, and there's, I think it's about 4,500 times a day that people use that search box on average, and we monitor that for quality control to make sure when they type something in, we can see what they get, and we want to make sure that they got what they were looking for, and we're always fine-tuning that for people. On the next page, my last two slides, I wanted to show you the Oregon Documents Repository. In the last session, you passed House Bill 2118, which directed the library to set up an electronic repository of state documents, and you mandated that all agencies must supply us with electronic copies of their publications. We created the repository. It went live in July. We currently have about 625 titles in the repository. They're fully accessible to anybody by going to the repository or going to their local library, so that's been very successful. And finally, I'll just mention our newest service that we're very proud of, which is a news service that you can get in your office if you would like. At 8:30 every morning in your email box, you can get headlines from the Oregonian, the Statesman Journal, the Register Guard, and the Medford Mail Tribune from that day's newspapers. These are articles that relate to state government and also opinion pieces that relate to state government. And by clicking below the headline, it takes you to the full text of the article. So it's a great way for state employees and legislators and anybody else that works for state government to keep up to date on what appears in that day's newspaper without actually having to subscribe to the paper and wade through it. So it's been a very, very successful service. And with that, Mr. Chair, I think I'm at 10 minutes, and I will be happy to take your questions.
Thank you very much, Mr. Shepke. Senator Devlin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Shepke, could you provide us with how we would start that service, or...
I will get in touch with your office immediately for the Eclipse service. Is that what you're referring to?
Yes.
Senator?
Yes.
I will do that immediately.
And, Mr. Chairman, a follow-up, different question, actually. On the Ready to Read program, that's a per capita. Is it still 86 cents per capita for the age population?
Mr. Chair, Senator Devlin, that is currently 84 cents,
well, 84 cents.
Per child per year. And in the governor's recommended budget, there's an increase proposed for that program.
Okay, what is the increase to?
The increase is to $1 per child per year, which is actually the funding, the highest funding level we reached back in the in 2001. It's really restoring the funding level to what it was before the most recent recession.
Okay. Thank you. That's kind of overdue.
Thank
not
you.
To use a pun.
Pun intended.
You've been waiting.
I apologize on behalf of the committee for that pun. Representative Morgan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. There have been a number of budgets that are impacted by federal funds, and yours is one of them. And we're getting a lot of news from the federal government about their desire to cut back on funding levels. I'm wondering if you're hearing anything like that with your funding sources?
Mr. Chair, Representative Morgan, we've been very fortunate that the First Lady, Laura Bush, is a librarian, as you may know. And, in fact, she went to the same library school that I did at the University of Texas. If that's where you're wondering about my accent, I'm a escaped Texan. And but she went to the University of Texas. She's been very supportive of library funding. So we've seen some modest increases in our federal funding. But this year, we're frozen at the same level as last year under the continuing resolution that you've probably heard about. And we are concerned for the future to continue to maintain that federal funding. It's absolutely crucial to us. It's mostly what funds our work with local libraries.
Thank you.
I actually had one question. When you mentioned the statewide database licensing program saving, I think you said $10 million. How unique is that in terms of, do other states have a statewide licensing program? Or is
yes, Mr. Chair, that's something that many, many states do, because we've learned that can save a tremendous amount of money as opposed to every single library, you know, negotiating those contracts with vendors. So that's been very successful.
Okay. And the LNET, where we can ask a librarian a question 24 hours a day, does that include sort of the latter part of June when this body is trying to negotiate and come up, we can send a question to a librarian?
Mr. Chair, in the middle of the night.
Okay.
You could do that.
And all right, you're on the record.
You know, it's you type in your question, and there's a librarian that responds, and they find the information, and then they actually push it to your computer. It's usually a website or some kind of information that they can actually push, and then you can print it out. So it works very well.
All right. Representative Edwards.
Mr. Chair and Mr. Shepke, in which formats are the electronic state documents saved in the documents repository?
Mr. Chair, Representative Edwards, we are currently saving the electronic documents in both PDF and SHTML formats. And we realize that this is just a temporary situation, because there's actually not a lot of standardization, as you may know, for a long-term archival permanent format for electronic documents. So we're watching the developments very closely, and as soon as there's a standard, we will actually be converting the documents into that standard. But we don't know when that will be, but we're prepared to do that.
Okay, thank you.
Any questions?
Great. Well, thank you.
Oh, Representative Warren,
this is a follow-up, if I may. Is the Department of Administrative Service working on that standard? Do you know?
That is actually something that will be a national standard that archivists and librarians are still working out at a national level within their associations.
So follow-up, some kind of open published standard?
Yes, absolutely. It won't be an Oregon standard. It'll be a national standard.
Don't go away yet. Is it Senator Morse?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The $600,000 that we have allocated in 0507 to the Ready to Learn program, will you be able to help us understand if, in fact, this is making a difference? And the reason I ask the question is sometimes you don't have enough critical mass, and looking at some of the grant allocations, they're quite small, and are they really making a difference by thinning the suit? That would be a question we could deal with later point in time.
If I could just comment, Mr. Chair and Senator Morse, the State Library Board has been very concerned about that very issue, and as a result, they proposed to the governor what has become House Bill 2116, which takes the Ready to Read program and really focuses it in two specific areas that research shows really have a difference in terms of getting more kids to become proficient readers, and those are early literacy training for parents and caregivers, and summer reading, to keep kids reading in the summertime. So that is what Senate Bill 2116 would do. It would also address your question by creating a minimum grant level of $1,000, which still isn't a lot, but it's more than some. We have libraries that get less than $100 with the per capita allocation. So the board feels that a $1,000 minimum grant will at least go part way to making sure that every library can do can have a program that really has an effect in their community.
Further questions? Representative Morgan.
Just a comment that I think that the point that Senator Morse raised is really important given the safety net funding issue for, I know that in my county, the county government supports the library system in the county extensively. And as those federal funds go away and the counties become less able to support the library system, the state's portion of that support is going to become much more significant.
Further questions or comments? Again, thank you very much, Mr. Shepke, and we won't tell the First Lady that you said that you're an escaped Texan. And we look forward to talking with you in the future. Thank you again very much.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. All right, and now I'd like to call Vicki Chamberlain, Executive Director of the Teacher Standards and Practices Commission, for an overview of that agency. Thank you very much.
I know, it told me two times. Members of the committee, thank you for indulging me. Chair Blasio, Vicki Chamberlain, the Executive Director of Teacher Standards and Practices Commission. And today I have a commissioner actually with me in the audience, Mary Lou Pickard, who is one of my public members. And I believe I can do this in 10 minutes or less. So this is the 30,000-foot level view, if you will. The commission was actually formed in 1965, and it wasn't separated, though, from the Department of Education until 1973. We didn't always have 17 members, but we do now, and here is the breakdown. 8 teachers, 4 administrators, 2 higher education representatives, 1 is public and 1 is private, and then 3 public members, one of which must be a school board member. So their terms are for 3 years, and they may fill up to 2 years. Other requirements are the licensed people must have practiced on their license within the 5 years before they're appointed. These are the agency's primary responsibilities. We actually do not have a statutory mission. Our directives, though, are to issue educator licenses, approve the preparation programs in which they graduate, and then do discipline based on ethical violations and based on their license. Here are some statistics, and what I have attached to the handout are some backup information for the statistics. But right now, there are, just as you can see, over 66,500 active education licenses that represent 61,500 educators. And what I have below that is a representation of our core staffing that supports the issuing of the licenses. We have 5 full-time public service representatives, and you see the breakdown of how they're working. Phones have been a big issue in my office, phone service. So we have 2 people on the phone from 7:30 to 5:30 every day, and that covers lunch as well. And we have redesigned to have 3 people answering email full-time and backing up some of our other services so that that doesn't get so backlogged. Then we have 3 licensure evaluators and 1 pre-evaluator who can determine incomplete applications early to try to save time. And then a coordinator who oversees these folks. just some data that may interest you. I'm not going to repeat each of them. You can read them, but you can kind of get an idea. This is 1 year, one half of the biennium's worth of data that comes through the office. I think the thing that surprised us was the imaging. We have used up a scanner since we started this process, so we did not really expect that kind of paper load, frankly. So we've imaged over 100,000 documents in just over 2 years. Program approval is another service the agency provides, and this is the programs I have listed here that universities that come to us for approval to offer teacher, administrator, school counselor, and school psychology licenses. And that little bullet that says five colleges and universities visits represents the ongoing repeated site visits that we do with teams to review whether or not they're actually delivering the programs that they brought to the commission and asked to have approved. So we do about five a year. What I have here are the actual universities and colleges in the state that offer programs. Here are the six public ones. The only one on there, two, I guess if you want to count OHSU, would be OIT, not on there. And then here are the private colleges and universities. And Lesley University is the only university that doesn't have what you would consider a home campus in the state, but they did deliver a program approval, and they've been approved through the Office of Degree Authorization to deliver programs in our state. Discipline is the third main core mission that we do, and here is a little breakdown of some of our statistics. You can see we have 187 cases pending. This page here in the handout is a breakdown to 1997 of our discipline statistics. And just to sort of unwind the code, if you look across the top in the gray box, NFA means no further action. So how you would read this first sort of line of actions for 06 is, in 06 the commission issued 91 orders. They could have been a suspension or a revocation or a reprimand. They charged 11 administrators, which means those are pending and that they may have asked for a hearing. They dismissed 47 cases, and they took no further action on 43 cases. And you may wonder what the difference is. There is none. And when I come to you before the committee, I can explain that distinction. But it is related over here on the far right to we dismiss patron complaints, and we take no further action on school district reports. So we try to keep track of that. But if you'll see, the far right column is a tracking of the reports that come in from the school district and reports that we receive from patrons. Sticking to our outline, relevant history that you may find interesting or pertinent is that we've been actually perfecting our service through improving our business processes, and that actually has a lot to do with our web services. Moving to the paperless applications allows our public service representatives to get instantly into files as they're on the phone without having to request them and having them delivered to the desk to talk to. We are actually, Representative Morgan will appreciate this, conducting some online credit card transactions for duplications, and we'll be rolling out our renewals next, and that's an exciting thing for us. And we also have a lookup function similar to the health boards for educators, and you can see their license, when it expires, what they're authorized to teach, what grade levels they're authorized to teach. And now you may also get on our license and define every single license defined, every single authorization defined, and access to the exact courses that they're authorized to teach on that license. And that's erased a lot of mystery for the public and for school districts. And we're piloting a direct connection with school districts that we're very excited about, because the school districts will provide us employment information which will populate experience forms to do renewals almost instantly when educators get online. So North Clackamas is one of the school districts that's working with us on the pilot for this. Here are our performance successes. I've mentioned a couple of these. A major one was getting our phone service off of copper wires onto fiber optics. It made a huge difference, actually, in our ability to capture data and have them leave messages and not have drop calls, so we haven't had as many complaints about that. And we also developed a fast-track system where Oregon graduates, based on a recommendation from universities, can get their license in 2 days. And how we do that is we do an audit with the universities to make sure that the information that's required for licensure is in there. That would be there. They've completed the program, their transcripts are all in place and in order, and we do spot audits, and it's gone very, very well. And out of state, we can't do that, but I can explain that in more detail when I come in front of the committee. So the contact log would be if I had an individual file, and that would be if anyone in our office had talked to them on the phone or by email, or they had walked in, what exactly had transpired. And I won't cover this. We've updated standards and issued more licenses last summer with a vacancy than we did the previous summer, so we did think that was a success. Our challenges, I think, are typical for small agencies, and that is that we have an illness or we have a vacancy, and it tends to roll us back really quickly. And we also have spread out a lot of duties and trying to redesign to do more customer service, so it has created some challenges. And but I still think that we have something really good going, and not too concerned about some of our lost efficiency. Illness can really roll us back, and I don't really quite know how to handle that, and when you have a staff of only 20. School years actually have created an interesting nuance that I do want to point out to you, and you can see some of it in the charts I gave you at the end of our handouts, but the this one that says C1's received, C1 is the form name for our applications, and the weeks are by the weeks of the year. These aren't by months, but these peaks are August and September. And when I say tsunamis, it's actually predictable in that school districts won't know this summer precisely what their school funding is going to be, so they'll be conservative about hiring. But they'll know what their budget is going to be next summer, so they'll start hiring in April and May and June. And Beaverton hired 350 new teachers this year, and with only 3 evaluators, if they don't come from Oregon to get the fast track, it can create a huge bottleneck in our office. And it's just one of those unique things about serving school districts. Here are our funding sources. We are one of those other fund agencies you discussed at the beginning of your meeting. All of our fees come exclusively from licensure or fingerprint fees. The end.
Thank you, Ms. Chamberlain. Senator Devlin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ms. Chamberlain, you know that we've had a lot of discussions, and I'm actually very impressed by your agency, but I'm always belief that agencies can do even better. Can I get a couple of things just sent to me? One would be, can I get an example of a packet that a teacher might, who is asking for initial licensure, might receive? And also what you might send to a teacher who's up for renewal, and what you might send to either of those cases when their responses are incomplete. And I did want to state one thing for the record, Mr. Chairman. We made a change in the law, I think it was either last session or the session before, Mr. Chamberlain would know, so that licenses were renewed on birth dates versus just simply the date. And that did appear to levelize part of it. But this thing in terms of fluctuating school funding and the fact that I think we've had more than a third of teachers in the last 5 years retire has really created some huge spikes for this agency in, as you can see, in starting in July and going into August. And I do think that's something we need to look at and see if there's any way to address that.
Excellent point. Senator Devlin, did you want to comment?
Yeah, Chair Glezio and Senator Devlin. I didn't mention, and I probably should have, one of the things that I think challenged us this summer was that the timing of the report for the highly qualified teachers for ODE to go to the federal government was in July. And to count transcripts and academic background as we have those records, we actually had to shut down issuing licenses for 3 weeks to do the high-quality teacher requests. So it's just those things that come in that you don't expect to just stop everything.
But I will provide that information.
Thank you very much. Other questions? Representative Edwards.
Mr. Chair, Ms. Chamberlain, has the Federal No Child Left Behind Act had any impact on your commission's workload?
That's one.
Yes, Chair Galizio and Representative Edwards, it's had an enormous effect on the workload in my office, and we've absorbed it because we do not get any of the money that has come in for that, which has actually so far worked out fine because it's once identified, you don't have to do it again, and we just have to get through the bubble.
Thank you.
Thank you. Further questions? I don't need a response now, but I did have one question. You mentioned Wesley University as one of the approved institutions. I'm not familiar with that. And I would be curious to know, and you don't have to answer now if it's not a brief answer, and then maybe it isn't. If the criteria that you use to approve institutions is the same whether or not an institution is in-state or is so-called, you know, virtual, and what percentage they might have of courses that are offered online, and how that does or does not affect the criteria that you use to approve institutions.
I'll make a brief answer and give you more information later. Leslie actually uses Umpqua Community College's campus to convene people. So part of their services are provided online and part of their services are provided directly. And they just, their main campus though is on the East Coast. And they are subject to site visits and so far have been delivering well. They are not a big program.
Mm-hmm.
But I can explain the program approval process any way you'd like me to.
Yeah, I'd love to know if, you know, I'd love to just look at the criteria and then see if there are any distinctions made. And when you look at these universities and colleges that offer quite a bit or everything, or quite a bit of their courses online. So I'd be curious about that. Other questions? Well, great. Well, thank you very much, Ms. Chamberlain, for that quick and informative view. We'll be seeing you in the not too distant future.
Oh, okay.
And with that, if there are no further comments or questions, I will close this informational meeting and this meeting is adjourned.